Check. 1, 2.
Absolutely. You just clip it wherever you want to. Everybody ought to wear one, right? Good, thank you. Don't let me leave with this. I've done that many times.
And I'll be kind of popping my head in to check the levels, so.
Okay.
I don't want you to feel like I'm interrupting.
If Dr. Turner is the only one that ends up in here, you don't really have to introduce me. But that's
except for the.
I'd like to introduce this.
Oh, except for the
except
mic.
Except for the recording.
That's right.
Yeah.
So how's your week been?
Here.
Here?
But kind of fitting in a little bit of work around the conference because I'm local.
Are you
teaching at the university?
Oh, at the university, great.
Yeah, University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Sure.
Yep.
Nice
yep.
place.
So we have a very small mass transit system, but I've gotten very accustomed to it in the last month. And so I popped down to Children's in Warshoe Hospitals to see my students who are doing their senior services. Worked out really well.
Great.
Yeah, some people have felt, and there were long breaks. So yesterday I went down, saw two students in the morning between the two sessions, and was back here in no time, no parking.
You're efficient.
Just rode it. Yeah.
Is your dean Susan Dean Bear? Oh, I just got an email. You're looking for some associate deans?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. That's wild. That was sitting right here. Yeah, she came in July from University of Wisconsin, Madison.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So I'm in my second semester of the DNP program at what we call UMSLS, how we shorten it here,
mm-hmm.
UMSL, and have an epidemiology exam. It's due next week. Well, it was released last night.
Oh, great.
Yeah, but you know, I looked at it. It's two main problems with lots of sub-questions underneath. I think
mm-hmm.
it's doable.
Good.
Yeah, at least the one she picked I like.
Good.
Yeah.
I like the structured courses. Epidemiology seemed very structured to me, and I liked that.
And she's very, you know, if you follow it, you'll do well.
You'll do fine, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One of those.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So when do you graduate?
Oh, gosh, probably not till 14. Maybe early 15 because I also signed up for the nursing loan program that's national to also.
Nursing faculty loan?
Yeah,
yeah.
So I have to do
the education
courses. So can I just walk for the DMP and then do my education courses? So I don't know. They intertwine them into the curriculum,
mm-hmm.
keeping up that whole.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Duke
mm-hmm.
does it as well.
We do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm full-time faculty, and then I have a little bit of clinical practice on the side and balancing everything.
It was an interesting discussion about integrating clinical practice with education.
Yeah.
And boy, we need to do more of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it makes you reputable and credible to the
yeah,
students.
To the students, because they know that you're practicing, it does help. There
yeah.
seems to be, even for CRNAs, there seems to be this great divide between educators and practitioners, even though most of us are a combination of
both.
Yeah, a lot of people don't.
Students in training, yeah.
Sure. A lot of CRNAs don't see that.
Mm.
So, but the more we can blend, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once again, students ask you a lot about practice, you know, when they're learning themselves. What do you do in your practice?
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen in your practice?
Mm-hmm.
I'm women's health, so it's pretty straightforward. OB or GYN.
Sure. Well, I know a little bit about St. Louis, and the most I know is driving through here, and it is by far the scariest city that I drive through. I go places. I just.
Because of the speed or the highways?
The combination of things, speed and stop go. It's stop and go the whole time if you hit it the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
Even the highways that go through here, you mean?
Well, the interstate.
The interstate, yeah. It can slow down.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, they have a kind of a weird little...
Yeah, we do grid with the highway system. Yeah, we had a lot of crossovers.
Oh.
Yeah, well, 270 almost does a circle around the city, and then you got 70 and 44 and 55 that all intersect in the downtown area.
Everybody seems to be merging, and then when you get down there downtown, I usually take the Martin Luther King Bridge, but that's a little frightening, too. Those big trucks on it.
Yeah, but your, well, Poplar Street is wider, but more congested, so
yeah.
Martin Luther is
it's quicker.
Easier to, uh-huh.
Seems cut off a little bit of time.
Right.
So I just take the chance that I won't go into the water.
Uh-huh. And then, two, heading over the Missouri River, which is St. Charles, if you're on 70,
yeah.
That bridge is pretty narrow, and people are really, you know, booking it there because it's not as much stop and go, but a lot of our population that moved out of the city into our county's bigger than our city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then people are moving to St. Charles County, which is across the Missouri River. They're moving west and west and west, white flight. And It's very congested over there. And you get out there, you're like, I would never live out here. It's crazy out here. Mm-hmm. But, no, this is the town I was born and raised in, and I really like it. Love being here. So, but you've never been able to stay to see any of the highlights?
Well, yeah, I used to have family that lived here, but this will age me a little bit. But when I was younger, we used to go down frequently and watch the arch being built.
Yeah, I was here when we were up. Yep.
It's a long time ago.
For heaven's sake, you got to see it being built.
The 60s, yeah.
It was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's pretty neat. There's a movie to it and a whole history museum underneath. Yeah, it's got a lot of rich, you know, beginning civilization history, too, right there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was telling others that have attended, I said, all of our museums are free, which is rare in a city, you know, a wonderful art museum, history museum, science museum.
What's that crazy museum? But I had to pay to get into it.
That looks like a
spaceship. It's got a something outside that you crawl through, and it's
City Museum.
City Museum. And it's got a two-story slide.
Uh-huh. And an airplane you can climb up
into. Yeah, that's what it is.
Uh-huh. No kidding. That sounds fascinating.
A very entrepreneurish kind of
interactive museum.
Yeah, he just passed away this past year, unfortunately, but the man was
craziness inside. It's got
always fought
everything.
With the safety issues.
Yeah.
But it's always packed. It's
got
a lot of traffic.
Well, I have one.
Well, do you want to?
Are they ready to start? Or
might as well. Yeah, we're actually a little after one, so we might as well go and get this recorded for posterity.
That's right. So they can make money off you, Steve.
That's right. That's what it's all about.
Well, we'd like to welcome Dr. Stephen Wooden, and he's here today to talk about the exploration of specialty certification for nurse anesthetists.
Thank you very much. That's exactly what I'm going to talk about. And we need to keep in mind, too, that the process that I developed in exploring this specialty certification is not just specific to CRNAs. It can be used as well in other advanced practice nursing specialties. And in just a little bit, I'll talk a little bit about some current issues that are going on that may drive this specialty certification. But I first, I first want to thank the Duke University School of Nursing for providing me with the resources and the educational material and tools to complete my DMP requirements. The Duke DMP Program Director, Dr. Barbara Turner, is here with us today. And I especially wanted to thank her for providing such a high-quality experience. The setting and population for this project was partnered with the National Board on Recertification and Certification of Nurse Anesthetist, also known as the NBCRNA. I received a lot of resource information from this organization. From their executive director, Dr. Ploss, who was also on the committee. The population addressed were certified registered nurse anesthetists that are in non-surgical pain management practices. Now, chronic pain disables more people than cancer and heart disease combined. It leads to divorce, poverty, homelessness, despair, and often suicide, unfortunately. Advanced practice nurses who specialize in anesthesia are well suited to address these problems using nursing theory, evidence-based practice, multidisciplinary interaction, and unique skills that CRNAs have to deliver pain management. Another important part of this process and this project were the licensing and credentialing processes that are run through state healthcare bodies. And these are critical to healthcare because they are linked to the demonstration of knowledge through this certification process.
Hi, Steve. I couldn't find you.
It's okay. This link of certification to licensing and credentialing is important to the profession, but probably more importantly, it promotes public trust. The certification body for CRNAs, the NBCRNA, is an autonomous body who conducted a practice analysis in pain management in 2007 and 2009, and used this information that was gathered during this period of time as a background for my project. I told you just a few minutes ago that there's a recent issue that has involved CRNAs that could very potentially involve other advanced practice nurses and may lead to the necessity of developing specialty certification in all advanced practice nursing areas. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services just recently evaluated a intermediary's decision not to pay CRNAs for pain management. The reason this intermediary did not want to pay us for these practices because they felt that CRNAs didn't have an educational basis or a credentialing program that established our abilities and identified our knowledge in this area. But probably the biggest driving force was the money, as most things are, and the money, as they looked at it, were a lot of people were becoming involved in pain management practices, and they wanted to limit those. And in doing so, they identified CRNAs as the first place they wanted to limit. I expect that later on they'll look at physicians who don't have specialized training in this area as well. But they focused on us, and this was a big problem because CRNAs practice in rural areas, and oftentimes for these rural populations, CRNAs are the only source, only reasonable source for pain management treatment. So we went to CMS and tried to get them to reverse this decision. So they did investigate it, and they introduced a new policy here recently that allowed for payment for CRNAs. And there was a comment period, and that just ended a few weeks ago. And during that comment period, we introduced a lot of information that showed that we indeed did have an educational basis. But this is the reason I addressed this a couple years ago in my DMB project. Our educational basis is somewhat scattered. We don't really have a credentialing process, and so I understand why they looked at our profession and decided that there may be some issues here. In doing so, through this reporting process, CMS came back to us and said, "Well, we'll tell you what. We'll really consider this process of payment for CRNAs if your professions, your professional organization, your credentialing organization, your educational organization will consider writing a letter to us indicating that you're going to focus in the next few years on putting together educational standards and credentialing." Well, it worked out very well for me because I've got the project here. The organization has come to me as well as some other experts in the area and want our input into doing this, but it certainly is something that we're committed to doing in the near future. Now, one of the other things that helped drive this project as well as the need for certification is the consensus model that was introduced by the National Council and State Boards of Nursing. And for those of you who are not familiar with the consensus model, and few of us are not familiar after it's been introduced, there's been a lot of discussion, so I'm assuming everybody here is familiar, but the consensus model for APRN regulation, also known as the LACE model for licensure, accreditation, certification, and education, is a model supported by 48 nursing organizations. including the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists, and it's intended to guide the future of advanced practice nursing. In fact, state licensing boards often refer to this model when considering changes to licensing for APRN regulations. I serve on the licensing board in Nebraska, and we often refer to this model when we look at regulations that we're developing. Now, this particular section in the LACE is concerning specialties and mentioning CRNAs and pain management. And it goes on to say that professional certification in the specialty area of practice is strongly recommended. So that also supports our efforts to certify in the specialty area. So what's the problem? CRNAs have been treating patients with chronic pain since the inception of nurse anesthesia practice. However, the specialty and scope of competency in this area of advanced practice nursing has not been well delineated, nor has a certification process been developed which would assist in setting these national standards for knowledge and skills. Awarding a certificate to those CRNAs who have taken the time and effort to demonstrate that they indeed possess this knowledge and skills will benefit the profession and the specialty practice of non-surgical pain management. It will strengthen efforts for CRNAs to maintain the right to practice in non-surgical pain management, but most importantly, it'll benefit the public. Competency is broadly understood to apply to someone who has the fundamental knowledge and ability and expertise in specific subject matter, as well as a skill set. The public assumes, right or wrong, that people who are certified in a specific area are competent, but at the very least, they understand that it represents that a professional has completed a curriculum of study and possesses the knowledge and skills to secure to serve the public in this certified capacity. Designing and implementing competency evaluation will help bridge the gap between continuing education and actual demonstration that an individual possesses the necessary knowledge and skills to practice in non-surgical pain management competently. The process of evaluating competency in a specialty area is more aligned with recertification than it is initial certification. And recertification is basically the continued accrual of knowledge and the consequences of application of that knowledge in contemporary practice. And that is really how we address these specialty certifications, because most people who have been practicing for a number of years have acquired the basic knowledge and they have gone beyond the initial certification needs, but we need to make sure that they have acquired the proper knowledge to practice in these specialty areas, and that's what this type of certification is all about. Now, I had certain goals that I wanted to establish for my capstone project, and here are my goals. I wanted to identify the target group for a competency evaluation. I wanted to identify the assessment tools that that we would use to assess this target group. And I wanted to identify sources of fundamental test items or the resources that are used in the specialty area, and then develop a knowledge and skill set outline that could be used to develop a competency evaluation if that's where the profession went in the future. Now, I want to go over the basics of these goals and identify exactly what I was trying to accomplish. As far as the target group was concerned, I identified that there could be two groups. It could be one group that self-identified and said, yeah, I practice pain management. We have a list of people that have self-identified. But are they really prepared to be evaluated? The second possible target group would be a group of people that had met a predetermined criteria. Now, the NBCRNA, when they did their practice analysis, and for those of you who came in the room after I described what these acronyms were, the NBCRNA is the National Board on Certification and Recertification of Nurse Anesthetists, and they're the credentialing body for all CRNAs in the country. The NBCRNA did a practice analysis, and their report suggested that suggested some criteria that I used as a starting point. And that criteria is listed on this slide, which includes, make sure you can read that, I think you can, the theoretical foundations of pain, imaging and radiation safety, assessment, diagnosis, and integration and referral, pharmacology, interventional pain strategies, and comprehensive pain treatment. And it also recommended a number of hours to be addressed in those areas. This all was based on educational programs that already existed for CRNAs. Now, the second goal was to identify assessment tools. Now, a number of professional organizations already have recertification and use a number of assessment tools for recertifying their professionals. And so I wanted to use this list to evaluate to see which ones were appropriate for specialty certification. Those tools could be continuing education, written exams, oral exams, peer review and quality assessment, chart review, references from other specialists, self-assessment, and holding credentials at an accredited facility. Although a written exam may be the most obvious method of evaluating the knowledge base of somebody, I wanted to consider all of these possibilities for specialty certification, either as a singular option or a combination of options. As far as the resources were concerned, I wanted to compile a group of resources that could be used as references to an evaluation process and check with experts to see what they use for their references. And finally, the fourth goal of developing a competency outline. Using the information from a variety of pain management educational resources, I established a draft educational outline to begin the discussion. In addition to the knowledge testing, I felt it was important that we consider skills assessment as well. Pain management is one of those things that skills are quite important, as you can imagine. Knowledge is important as well, but it's an integrated process. It's very difficult to separate the knowledge and the skills. So I felt that it was important that we consider both of those, and I developed a skill set outline as well using those same various educational resources. Now, the first step in achieving the stated goals was to assemble a panel of experts composed of those individuals identified within the profession as leaders in non-surgical pain management practice. The role of this panel was to evaluate data related to the goals of the project and establish validity of this data. The MBCRNA had developed a database of individuals who had self-identified as pain practitioners. We went through that database and identified those people who had a unique skill set and a unique position in the profession. Those people we felt could be identified as experts with certain criteria. That criteria included that they had participated in such activities as publishing relevant material, delivering national presentations, or participating in research and education on the subject of non-surgical pain management. The selected advisory committee members were from different geographic locations, a variety of practice settings, and they provided unique expertise in various areas of non-surgical pain management. Now, what I enjoyed most about this whole project was learning about the Delphi method, which you may or may not be familiar with, but I found it to be a fascinating tool and a very valuable tool in what I did, because it's very difficult to start from a scattered bunch of information and try to bring it together in a scientific way. The Delphi method actually allowed me to do this with these experts that we had identified. And just to tell you a little bit about the Delphi method, it was a process developed in the 50s by the RAND Corporation for the Department of Defense to evaluate and predict the impact of a nuclear attack on the United States. As you can imagine, they didn't really want to go out and do random selection of the public and try to find out what their feelings were about a nuclear attack. It would create problems. And in this respect, this was helpful for me as well. I could have done a random sampling of CRNAs to do the same thing. But in investigating the Delphi method, I found that it had been well studied over the years and frequently used in the last 50 plus years. And research has found it to be a valid method as an effective decision-making tool. But there were four criteria that really needed to be included in doing this method, and they were quite important to the validity of the process. Those four criteria were anonymity. In other words, we needed to make sure that people didn't share information that influenced them, that there would be interaction with feedback, so there needed to be some method without creating this dynamic environment where people were influencing others, but there still needed to be feedback. There needed to be statistical analysis of the group response and expert input. The techniques employed in this proposal consisted of a round of data evaluation and input from the advisory committee under these controlled conditions, as I just described. Each member of the advisory committee was asked to review the material, rank the material, and provide any additional items that they felt that were relevant to the question. And we would do rounds of evaluation, which would allow each member to gather information and then make their decision based on the information from previous rounds. Evaluation, ranking, and analysis of the material presented to the advisory committee continued until the responses statistically fell within the established norms, and I'll describe those norms here in just a few minutes. Now, there were four domains that I wanted to have the group evaluate based on the goals that I had established, and they were very well coordinated with each domain representing one of the goals. And I called those groups of information data sets and had the advisory committee asked to evaluate those data sets as we move forward. As far as the statistical analysis was concerned, a descriptive analysis was first completed at each round, which included statistical information appropriate to each data set. The data sets were different enough that I had to choose an appropriate evaluation process for each of them, as you will soon see. The mean and the median were, when appropriate, helped determine the overall opinions of the advisory committees concerning the data sets. The standard deviation, when applicable, was important to help establish the consistency of opinion between members of the advisory committee. Fidelity was evaluated comparing the outcomes of the information developed by the advisory committee to the information acquired through the NBCRNA practice analysis. And as mentioned earlier, validity of the four domains was evaluated using a Delphi method. And then reliability, which was also important, was evaluated by comparing the advisory committee's results to a sampling of CRNAs who had self-identified as pain practitioners. And finally, a kappa statistic was used to determine the inter-rater reliability between the advisory committee and the subsequent CRNA sampling. Now, I'll now describe how each data set was evaluated and the results of that evaluation. Data set number one, the target group. Each member of the advisory committee was asked two questions in this data set. The first question was to choose one of the seven options that I had listed here. The options included that basic set of CRNAs, which would be those who had self-identified. And then I listed a number of criteria based on the NBCRNA report of what they recommended, and then the combination of those items to see what these experts felt was the most appropriate item to use for identifying the target group. The second question was to determine if the practice requirement recommended by the NBCRNA was appropriate. They had recommended a requirement of 320 hours plus 10 procedures per week to be accomplished in order to be qualified to take certifying examination. The threshold for determining consensus in question number one was 80% approval, which is fairly standard. And the question number two was simply a collection of opinions that were statistically evaluated. The results of data set number one were as follows. As you can see from the slide, the first round produced a number of different answers. It was spread all over the place, and none of which really met the threshold. So I asked if there were any additional options that this group felt needed to be added, and none of them had any additions to this. So we went to the second round, and those items that in the first round that were selected by less than 20% of the group were removed, and this helped narrow the field a little bit. And in addition, 87.5% of the members expressed concern about the procedures per week and the practice requirements. So numbers of procedures were removed for the next round. And this allowed them to focus more on what they thought were important. And so in round three, we did get some consensus, as you can see here. I received more comments on question number two, which had to do with practice, than anything else, and there was a great deal of discussion about that as we exchanged information. Members expressed concern about including hours of procedures and hours and procedures in the requirement for active practice. Many of the advisory committee members said that they felt that active practice was quite important, but specific numbers may have no meaning at all, or at the very least could be difficult to confirm. So they felt uncomfortable about trying to identify those numbers. Those that offered alternative numbers as listed on this slide did so with hesitation. They kind of said, well, I really don't agree with having any numbers, but if you really have to have a number, here it is. And it was somewhat arbitrary. Now, interestingly enough, my capstone chair, Dr. Dougherty, had been involved in some research concerning practice hours with pediatric nurse practitioners. And here's a couple of very good references in that area. The references talked about respected authorities such as the Institute of Medicine and the Pew Commission when they suggested that there is very little evidence to suggest that a required number of clinical hours translates into skill acquisition and competency. In addition, this comprehensive study on pediatric nurse practitioner education discusses the complex issues surrounding clinical experience and why it may be difficult to quantify clinical experience. And I would recommend that anybody who has an interest in this area read these two articles. I think they will help you understand where the issues lie and where the problem lies in using this. And in fact, just recently, as the MBCRNA is changing its recertification criteria, we have had for many years a practice requirement, a fairly minimal practice requirement for CRNAs to be recertified. But as we evaluated the evidence in this area, we decided to drop that requirement. We felt that at this time we really didn't have enough evidence to say that somebody who practiced in a endoscopy lab for 420 hours was any more competent than somebody practiced in a trauma center for 400 hours. One of them met the criteria and the other one didn't. And for that reason, we're going to continue that evaluation. But we also understand that clinical practice is quite important. And we know that facilities as well as states have their requirements, so we're not abandoning that at all. We know that others will investigate that as we try to come up with better scientific evidence that, at what point does that qualify for our profession. Yes?
So, Steve, are you in conversation with the Council on Accreditation? Because they're proposing that we up the number of student cases from...
We have a question.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
So are you in conversation with the Council on Accreditation? Because when we're revising the doctoral standards now, it appears that we're going to go from a minimum of 650 cases to a minimum of 750 cases, and the number seems to be pulled out of thin air. although Betty Horton tells me that that all programs could meet that.
Well, you know, pulled out of thin air is probably an accurate description. We have been in discussion with them. Of course, they're a separate entity, separate body. They make their own decisions. We felt that our decision had to be made on scientific evidence, and we couldn't find any that would help us make that decision on a specific number. They may or may not have evidence that those numbers are adequate for their purpose. I can't tell you.
Again, I can have a student do 750 colonoscopy sedations, and they would be ill-prepared for the career in nurse anesthesia.
The extra 100 that they want to add, is that in a specific area subset? Because, you know, they're all divided.
Right.
Is that in abdominal? Because I know they've lessened the requirements for issues such as central lines and, you know, SWAN. I wondered how that was distributed. If they had a purpose for how that was distributed, you know, is it monitored anesthesia care cases? Is it general anesthesia care cases in certain areas?
Well, I've been involved in the discussion. I am not involved with the Council on Accreditation other than our communicative relationship with them from the MBCRNA. I do serve on the MBCRNA, but I don't know what their discussions were about that. But I suspect what they were was similar to what I did with the Delphi process. They brought experts in, they got their opinions, and they decided that as they evaluated students and their ability to practice after graduation, that there may be some limitations because of their previous standards. They even talked about lowering many of the standards, but there was a lot of blowback from that from professionals and practitioners. So I can't answer your question of why they did this. I suspect there is no scientific evidence to support it, just expert opinion. But expert opinion is valuable. And we just have to move forward. And I hope that at some point they will evaluate their previous standards with their revised standards and determine if there really is improvement in student preparation. That's really the only way that they're ever going to determine if what they've done is valid or not. To answer your question. How would you measure those outcomes? Well, that we've explored that as well with our MBCRNA, with our recertification process revision. We've explored how to do that. And of course, we've got to put it in place before we can actually do those studies. But you have to identify some specific item. And as an example, when we look at studies that showed that certification did improve patient care, those studies were based on specific criteria such as treatment of hypertension, treatment of diabetes. We have identified core competencies that we think all CRNAs need to know. We could take those core competencies and take a look at outcomes based on lawsuits or some other criteria that shows how how problems are created, such as airway problems. We know that as CRNAs, airway issues are still the number one issues, still the number one lawsuits filed against anesthesia providers. We could go back and look at the lawsuits filed against CRNAs concerning airway management problems before the new criteria was put in place, and then revisit it later and to see if those have improved. That is an example of how we would evaluate that criteria. Otherwise, it becomes so complex and there are so many variables to doing it, it becomes difficult. And that's why after all these years of recertification with the maintenance of certification that physicians have, the recertification process that CRNAs have, that it's difficult to identify scientific studies that can show for sure that our certification process has improved patient care, unless we just identify singular items to evaluate. Anyway, I think we got just a little bit off in the weeds there, but we'll get back to that.
Sorry.
No, no problem. I enjoy this conversation. I just want to make sure that I'm answering your questions as adequately as I can. Data set number two had to do with assessment tools and what we would use to assess CRNAs in the specialty practice. And so I used the same method as I did before, using a Likert scale to evaluate whether the presented items were acceptable to the advisory committee. We asked them if they agreed with these assessment tools, somewhat agreed that they should be used, or disagreed that they should be used. And after the first round, all the items with a mean score equal to or greater than 2 were removed. This threshold provided for the determination that an item is at least somewhat acceptable to these experts. The variance was also checked to assure that there was not a very large split between the advisory committee members' opinion. It most likely, if there was a large variance, then it's probably due to a poorly constructed question. But fortunately, there was little variance in the response. Now, this is data set number 2, and this is what we found after the advisory committee evaluated it. When we asked what tools should be used for competency assessment and certification, the advisory committee chose the following 4: a written examination, demonstration of technical skills, completion of an established curriculum content prior to credentialing, and surprisingly, clinical practice requirements. Now, we just discussed why that may not be valid. The group actually rejected the numbers that I had presented to them. But as I evaluated this further, I don't think this was as odd as I thought it was, because they actually told me that they didn't like the number of specific hours being identified because they didn't think it was valid, but they felt it was very important that that those who were practicing or taking the certification examination actually had an active clinical practice. What we have to identify now is how to demonstrate that you have an active practice. What criteria should we use to establish that? Now, in data set number 3, I essentially ask the advisory committee to provide me with the reference material, their go-to reference material. The members provided 27 references, which included books, journals, and websites. And finally, in data set number 4, I took that draft skill set outline, presented it to the advisory committee, asked them to add or subtract items from it, and to evaluate it as well. I wanted them to look at the practice domains and other material developed using the MBCRNA practice analysis. I also told them that the curriculum content of the non-surgical pain management educational processes were included in here, as well as other organizations that provided educational material for CRNAs. And that's how this outline was developed. The advisory committee was asked to rank these items with the same 3-point Likert scale used before. The same thresholds were used as well. And they were asked if they agreed with the assigned percentages of the test weights for each domain, in addition to the domain material. There was no significant disagreement with the weights. Now, once we went through this evaluation, there were recommendations for performance domains with the recommendations of weights and the tasks of clinical practice, practice evaluation and improvement, and professional responsibilities, along with recommendations for the curriculum content. And I'll just go through these briefly. This is the outline for theoretical foundations of pain, which would be 8% of the test. Imaging and radiation safety, which should be 8% of the test, as well as the curriculum content. And as you can see, each of these are broken down into those 3 areas of clinical practice, practice evaluation, improvement, and professional responsibilities. Assessment, diagnosis, integration, referral, 26%. Pharmacology, 8%. Interventional pain strategies, which was the largest area, which was 34%. Comprehensive pain treatment, 16%. And then in addition to that, the skill set outline was evaluated in the same fashion, and these are the issues that they felt as far as skills were concerned that would cover the areas that are necessary for CRNAs to perform. And they felt that these could be done, evaluated adequately using cadavers or simulation. And 87.5% of the group found all components appropriate for weight, curriculum content, and technical skills. One member felt that more content should be directed towards theoretical foundations and pharmacology. And there were no items that the advisory committee felt were in the wrong domain. So I went through the advisory committee. I felt that we had valid information based on the Delphi method. I now wanted to determine the reliability of this data, and the best way that I found to do that was to take this group of CRNAs who had self-identified, and there were some 611 individuals who do that. I then asked them the same questions using the same criteria, and there was a return rate of 25.36%, which was quite good for a survey like this. I think these are highly motivated people. They understand the political issues within the specialty area, and they were more than interested in participating. The same 80% threshold was used and for the CRNA sampling, and I used SPSS to evaluate the outcome from the advisory committee and the CRNA sampling survey groups. And after analysis, the inter-rater reliability was found to be a kappa of 0.68. Most experts agree that a kappa greater than 0.60 is significant for a substantial level of agreement. So I was comfortable that we had reliability with this. So based on all of that, I came up with some recommendations. CRNAs who qualify to be certified and or recertified in non-surgical pain management should demonstrate the following. They should demonstrate that they have completed a curriculum content outlined by the MBCRNA or the COA, depending on where this whole process falls within whose realm. The successful completion of a written examination and technical demonstration of skills should also be necessary. Completion of 100 hours of approved continuing education in the prior five-year period should be used for future recertification, and individuals should have an active pain practice. There were some considerations that came up with the discussion among the advisory committee members and some emails that I received from some of the other ones that we did the survey with. These considerations included that the number of hours and number of procedures to demonstrate active clinical practice may not be helpful in demonstrating competency. And I think the scientific evidence at this point helps to support that. Further, the study needs to be done in an appropriate way to verify that an active clinical practice what an active clinical practice is and its impact on competency. In other words, we need to find a way to identify people who are in active clinical practice that is valid. Written and technical demonstration of knowledge or skills should be conducted by peers. Continuing education should be part of the ongoing educational process, but should not be the sole basis of a certification or recertification. There should be an easy access to educational programs so that CRNAs in active practice can obtain the necessary curriculum requirement. And finally, development of curriculum concerning non-surgical pain management must be an evolving process and should include characteristics of nursing philosophy and nursing process. I felt felt that it was very important that any good study like this should be valid, should be reliable, have fidelity. And I made sure that I included all of that in this. Of course, the Delphi method has been supported as a tool to provide valid information. That's where the validity came from. Using the survey from practicing CRNAs helped me establish reliability. And both the advisory committee and CRNA sampling survey were constructed with fidelity to the NBCRNA report and the NBCRNA vision. Now, in conclusion, I believe that this information will provide a sound scientific basis for a foundation in developing an anesthesia pain specialty recognition program and certification. This innovation is a critical component to the vision of the CRNAs and the NBCRNAs in its development of a specialty recognition program. It is important to their effort to have the non-surgical pain management recognized by legislators, regulators, and policymakers as a specialty practice within the scope and education of CRNAs. An important part of the sustainability will be continuing to evaluate this process over time and validating the tools and maintaining contemporary information going forward and assuring fidelity to the overall organizational visions and competency, patient safety, and effective practice. So the final question is, what is specialty certification really all about? Some say it may be about politics, but it's really not. Is it about professional competency? Well, I would say partially it is. But the thing that it is really about is patient trust. And if we are going to have patient trust in our specialty nursing fields, we're going to have to come up with solid educational standards and competency evaluation processes so the public can feel comfortable that anybody that is treating them has the knowledge and skill set to do so in a competent manner. And I'll take any additional questions that you might have at this point. No more questions?
I'll use the microphone.
Yeah, please do.
So, Steve, would this predict other specialty certifications in obstetrics and pediatrics, CV?
Yeah, I certainly do see that as a possibility. As we evaluated this, I could see other areas within nurse anesthesia practice that could benefit from this process. Those areas included cardiovascular, as you mentioned, pediatrics, obstetrics, pain management, thank you, and something that came up during the networking at this conference was how about education? And I think that was a very important area that needs to be considered for specialty certification.
It would actually be nice to have a fellowship in education, a postdoctoral fellowship in education for nurse anesthesia.
We're
not quite there yet, but there are a lot of things that I have learned over the years. I've only been a program director for 2 years. And I have taken education courses, but it would be really sweet to have a curriculum developed that would prepare people to become educators in nurse anesthesia, and particularly our clinical preceptors. We depend so much on them.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes.
Hello. I wanted to ask a question similar to hers.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Rebecca Collier. I'm a DNP student from Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. I'm in the first cohort there, but I'm a CRNA at St. John's Children's Hospital in Springfield, Illinois. Okay. And about 90% of my patient population is children. And there is, scattered across the country, there's a post-master's certification in pediatric anesthesia for CRNAs. And I have looked at a few of those programs because several of the anesthesiologists I work with are board certified in peds anesthesia, and we don't have that same option for CRNAs. We just have like this, what you're talking about, a specialty kind of certification for us, mm-hmm. which I am interested in because, you know, when you look at a postmaster's certificate for a CRNA who's been in practice for all will have been 9 years in January, you know, quitting your job, relocating to a different city, and then undertaking that certificate program. But that wasn't examined in this, correct? You just looked at kind of expectations from the advisory panel and then current practice and years of experience in that, your...
That's correct, but one of the recommendations that we had is that practicing CRNAs need to have ready access to those programs. As you mentioned, it would not be very useful if you had to quit your job,
yes.
move away, and then what do you do then?
Yeah.
We've got to find ways in these specialty areas to educate. The advent of outreach learning, mm-hmm. or a blend of
sure.
those of on-campus out,
well, and my
will help.
My hospital serves as I'm the clinical coordinator for the university that I'm getting my DNP from for their CRNA students, and we do specialty peds rotations for SIU and Decatur Memorial Hospital in Illinois. So I have students all the time. So I'm in a clinical instructor training role consistently, of which I get no continuing education credits from the AANA. Mm-hmm. And nor am I adjunct faculty with either university that I serve in that capacity for. So I just feel like there's a lot of room here where the bedside clinical instructors could receive some positive continuing education.
Well, you
through
will.
The AANA. I called them last year about it, mm-hmm. and they said that there is some discussion to that, because our nurse practitioner colleagues do get continuing education credit hours for having students in the clinical arena.
I'll first address an issue that we have separating the organizations. The continuing education criteria is set up by the MBCRNA. And most people see the MBCRNA and the AANA as one entity, and it's not. They're two separate
sure.
organizations. And we're trying to brand ourselves as an MBCRNA and educate CRNAs so that they don't get the two mixed up,
mm-hmm.
because it does create a problem. As the MBCRNA, and you may be aware that we have just introduced a new certification mm-hmm. program, continuing professional certification, that will go into effect in 2016. And with that, we have taken that component of continuing education and broke it up into two parts. The conventional continuing education that you get now, that you're required to have, 35 hours a year?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it 20 hours a year? 20 hours a year. That's what it is, 20 hours a year, isn't it?
It's 20 hours a year. My state requires 50 two.
So your state actually requires more than what the MBCRNA currently requires. What we're going to do is break that up. That's pretty typical. We're going to break that up into two components. The continuing education numbers have actually been lowered a little bit, but all of them will have to be assessed. You'll have to take a test to demonstrate that you gained some knowledge from those. You can no longer go to a meeting, sign in, and go out to the golf course. That was
sure.
a big problem that we had. So you'll have to have some type of assessment. Now, you can get those online. You can do assessment online. You can get those on, through different methods rather than coming to meetings and having to take a test. The additional component, which addresses your concern, is professional activity units. There will be a number of professional activity units that you'll have to get. And those will be listed as we develop or operationalize this. As we develop it, you will find that your teaching and your hospital activities, your professional activities at a state and national level and local level will be included in those. And you'll be able to put those in through your personalized web portal.
So it'll be through the MBCRNA, not the AANA
That's
website.
Correct. That's
correct. Because currently we go there, like if I want to submit for even my university courses, I have to submit for approval through the AANA. Now that
right.
will be going through the MBCRNA.
Yep. You'll have two options. You can, since you're a member of the AANA, they will continue to keep track of those credits for you, and you can go through them. They have the mechanism of doing that. But as far as the rest of the things that aren't assessed, such as your professional activity units, the fact that you had taken modules, and some of the other requirements in the new recertification process, you'll go onto a website that will be designed for you, and you'll put that information in. What I would recommend that you do if you want to know more about this program is go to mbcrna.com. Mm-hmm. We have a brand new website that was just introduced 2 days ago, and it's very easy to get around, and there are some frequently asked questions about the new recertification process, and I think it will enlighten you and help answer your questions about that. But if you ever have problems about it, you can always contact.
Well, I'm thrilled anybody. To hear they're even considering it, because clinical preceptorship, you don't get a lot out of it except for, you know, kind of that professional perk on your resume. But I think continuing education credits are warranted, because you do have to stay up to date quite a bit. And it is not easy, especially in a specialty rotation, to train SRNAs. So it takes a lot of time out of your day. So I'm thrilled to hear they're even considering that.
Well, we felt it's more than a consideration. It's going to happen.
Good, great.
And we felt the same way that you did, that we have got to find a way to encourage people to be involved professionally.
Yeah, and I think you'll find clinical instructors do a better job. Right now, I have a terrible time with clinical instructors. My colleagues, professional colleagues, it's a burden for them to have a student. This is some motivation for the CRNA at the bedside to get involved with their education more. So I think that's great. I think, hopefully they'll take a better interest in it. So
I appreciate your input. It makes me feel better about the program.
Yeah, and just thank you for being a clinical preceptor for these students, for a clinical coordinator.
Absolutely.
If I can get this out of here, I'd be doing better. I can't tell you how much we rely on those people as program directors and educators. I couldn't do it without the people that are willing to take on that extra task. I try and see to it my folks are at least affiliate faculty. So you might put a bug in the ear of your program director.
I'm working on that, yeah.
because that will help you. You get access to the library and things like that, at least with the University of Minnesota, and that helps you to stay current. But my other question was for you, Steve. I guess it's a matter of definition of what exactly pain management is, because I have colleagues that are out, you know, on the western border of Minnesota where the wind blows all the time, and they're doing steroid epidurals once in a while. Mm-hmm. Now, they do labor epidurals all the time, so I'm not sure that these folks would ever qualify for the number of hours that you're proposing. But nevertheless, they're providing their critical access hospitals, and otherwise people would have to hop in a car with a bad back and drive to Rochester or Twin Cities. So what do we do with those folks?
Well, we want to encourage those practitioners to get a more comprehensive education in pain management, because there is much more that we can do to help people than just place some steroid in the epidural space. And sometimes that may be helpful for a limited number of people, but it's a disservice to those patients to not evaluate the entire aspect of pain management and look for alternatives. I know a number of people like you have just described who are what we call needle jockeys, who just inject people, and that's all they do. And the patients don't get a comprehensive evaluation or treatment that they could get. So if we could start this program, these people, because they should be allowed to continue their practice in whatever aspect they have within state law, they'll probably be allowed to continue to do that. But there may become a point where the insurance companies or CMS will no longer pay them because they're not certified. This may encourage them to go back and become certified, and in doing so, they'll have to get the comprehensive education and finish the curriculum that will be established. We just have to make sure that they have access to it, that they don't have to quit their jobs to move to these areas. And I think we can do that. We've got one program now that is providing that, and we're hoping to see other programs develop that will allow this, because education has become so much more accessible.
Yeah, well, they virtually couldn't leave. I mean, these are two solo practitioners that are at critical access hospitals, and you couldn't do it.
Yeah, I represent that remark. I certainly understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
Certifications, then we need them.
I agree. That's why I got involved in this, because not that we don't have the education, it's just that we need to establish those standards so that we can't be questioned. As advanced practice nurses, I feel sometimes that we have to reach for a higher standard than our physician colleagues, because we are constantly questioned, and they are seldom questioned in that respect.
Yeah, there is not a way that you could get that curriculum content into an entry-level nurse anesthesia program. It could not be done, with a DMP and a few other things thrown in. It would be very difficult to incorporate that entire curriculum into the entry-level curriculum.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Only want to do the peds they need to do to get through school. They have no desire to do any complicated ped surgery or any neonate kind of thing. So it doesn't make sense to do it in the entry level DNP.
No, I agree, and that's certainly a broader issue, but I will end this because we're at 2:00 right now. I'll end this with one comment. This is something that we're starting to explore as a professional organization and some of our educational institutions. What do we do with the DMP program for CRNAs? Should it be offered at a BS to DMP as an entry level practice? Probably, but how about people who are out there practicing that want to focus and specialize? This is the perfect opportunity to look at a focused educational program in areas such as pain management and pediatrics, cardiovascular education, and obstetrics. And I think that would attract a lot of practitioners who are out there now that hold master's degree to go back and get that specialty education, because they've always wanted to focus in that area. And maybe they are focusing in that area, but now they can get this additional education and credential to identify that they have.
Yeah, I heartily agree, Steve. I think the Hamline program is a good start. I think if that was hooked to a DMP degree, you'd be trampled by people wanting to do it.
I would agree with you. Tell Dr. Turner that.
I heard it.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you again for your support, Dr. Turner, and the Duke University. Just fabulous.
Thanks.
You too. Process for entry-level students as well as practicing CRNAs to do just that. And when we develop this certification process, we're going to have to look at that, because the future will be BSN to DMP. And eventually, we won't have these master's practitioners trying to seek this. So we have to develop a process for both of them if they want to focus. And I agree with you completely.
Those DMP learners, if that's their area of interest, they become your foundation for the future. So you'd want them to be participating in these professional advisory opportunities that you could access them to through your national.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're building this new leadership through their capstone.
Speaking to
do
the choir.
group projects and. Seem like that's why a BSN to DMP would exist, is to take them through the essentials, but then elevate them
forward
into their what they're going to call their advanced practice specialty. Mm-hmm. Then they graduate their DMP, they should be able to sit for both exams, mm-hmm. Right?
Exactly, because they met the curriculum.
I mean, they shouldn't
criteria.
Have to go find more curriculum.
Yeah. And we got
to
keep that in mind. I think somebody said it earlier.
Otherwise,
that
it's not.
We don't need people to start over once they've reached that level.
Yeah.
We need to find ways use their
curriculum. That's the market to it.
Right.
If they can graduate with their area of specialty,
right.
Certified,
in basic and it, and in an advanced specialty, then it's marketable.
Exactly.
Otherwise, why would you then spend more time and money to do a post-doctorate to get specialized in palliative care?
I would tack that onto a six-month add-on. You know, that, because a lot of students, when they graduate, they don't know that they want to specialize. I think pain management is probably one of those things that, you know, you don't come upon until later in your career. But I could easily envision making this a six-month or a two-semester add-on to prepare them for their postdoctoral
like
certification.
Or
yeah, yeah.
Like
you call
a
it a fellowship,
fellowship.
Yeah. A pain management fellowship, or a OB or PEDS fellowship.
Yeah, but for those that do know what they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, they could just roll right into it.
I wouldn't ask them to, and I'm talking about just anesthesia, but for any of these advanced practice areas, informatics, or, mm-hmm. I mean, they should be able to graduate their DMP.
It'd be tough to do that in anesthesia curriculum.
Yeah
but just because it's so chock full now.
Yeah.
But she's right. I mean, you're right. Both of you are right. You could add whatever. If they want to focus, then there could be, we need to have a jump-off point rather than a start-over point.
Yes.
And the leadership discussion starting from the very inception of their.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to declare something to do a BSN to DMP, except that they just want to be.
They want to be practiced.
I mean, they wouldn't be a good DMP candidate if they're just going in.
Now, what we're going to find is these specialty areas are going to develop, and they're going to be attached to payment, as pain management is going to be soon. And so we're going to get people who want to go into pain management at some point say, well, I'm going to have to get the certificate somehow, so how can I do this within the framework that I have? And things will evolve.
Yeah, they will.
And the curriculum will be there for them. They may have to do additional work, but it'll do.
It's all right.
And they might
be
willing. You
better billing on the back end of it.
Yeah.
Then,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you for attending. I was tickled to see a non-CRN here. So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yeah.
Kathy, I've got to catch up.
Well, actually.
Yeah, so.